Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Michael York, who's written a book, Are My Blinkers Showing? Adventures in Filmmaking in the New Russia, which is about making a film as an actor in Russia 2 years ago and then following through on what it was like to promote it in Russia. Michael York has written several books, but he's better known as an actor with a tremendous list of credits, including Cabaret, Murder on the Orient Express, Logan's Run, Something for Everyone, a particular favorite of mine, Taming of the Shrew, Accident, Romeo and Juliet, and we'll talk a little bit about that and about some of the incredible people you've worked with over the years. But first, let's talk a little about Are My Blinkers Showing? You were working on a movie called Moscow Heat, which is kind of an action potboiler, right?
It was indeed. And action was the least part of it, as I write in the book. You know, the attraction for me, I admit that I'm totally seduced by location. And here, out of the blue, came this offer to go to Russia, to go to Moscow, to make the biggest independent Russian movie then made, but in English, entirely on location in Moscow, with a pretty interesting role. So there were a lot of factors going for it. What I love about being there, not as a tourist, is that there's time to, you know, interface with the people, to get to know their lives a little bit. You know, you're not just sweeping by, watching the world from your air-conditioned coach or hotel room.
When you're here in America or in Britain, everybody knows who Michael York is. When you're over there, are there a lot of people who don't know who you are and you can kind of get the impression of what it's like not to be a celeb walking around?
During the Cold War, during communism, there were several movies from the West that were shown, and someone told me that, you know, that Cabaret was one of them. And it was like an old friend, he said. Films like Romeo and Juliet, for example, were enormously popular.
So the Michael York mystique traveled over there.
Well, actually, it was there when my first visit in the early 70s. I'd been in the first of the miniseries, a BBC production of the Forsyte Saga, which actually had played in Russia, too. But They played it back-to-back every night, all 20 episodes. My few episodes coincided with my visit, so it was extraordinary to be stopped in Red Square by people with their little bouquets of flowers.
What was that feeling like the first time? Of being recognized in a place like Russia.
Very gratifying. There's a strong sense that the Russians appreciate their artists.
You were there in 1970, which means you were there at the height of the Cold War. I was there, I think, Christmas 69, and I got to see about the same thing you did. And, of course, I have not been back since, but you have. It's a different world now.
Oh, completely. You know, I obviously try and write about the changes, try and understand them. And I admit, you know, the book is not a sociological study. I don't know how much what is going on in Moscow is representative of the rest of Russia. I suspect it's rather like Shanghai is unrepresentative of the great mass of China. But it's thrilling because everything has been cleaned up and transformed, and they're doing it so fast that the conservationists and preservationists are very alarmed that all these old buildings are being torn down. Someone said it's the greatest urban transformation since the era of Brezhnev.
Michael York, a movie like Moscow Heat, what happens? The script just comes to your agent with location at that point?
I once worked with David Niven, and he had this little catechism. It was where, who with, and how much. I'm not sure in which order. But the where part, of course, as I've mentioned, was an important factor. No, you get these scripts and you make up your own mind. You know, thank God, it's your own career.
Well, how do you make that decision? I mean, at this point, you know, Michael York is, you know, no longer going to be playing, well, he might be playing opposite Liza Minnelli.
Oh, that would be nice. Yeah.
It's a different story. How many scripts do you normally get in the course of, say, a month or two?
I get a lot. And a lot of them, like, you know, there was this little script called Austin Powers that showed up, and it was a film that was being made on for scale, practically, and thank God the instincts proved right, because it turned into this behemoth. This rule about Hollywood that nobody knows anything, I think, is an important factor.
You mentioned that in the book.
Yes, and if it wasn't said, that it should be said, because it levels the playing field. Nobody knows what they've got until they've got it. You know, you don't know if your little movie is going to be the next Blair Witch or whatever. And, in fact, Moscow Heat will be coming out distributed by Universal, which is great. And I'm happy to say that Universal are putting their, I think their the first order is 10,000 copies of the DVD, and in every one they're putting a little slip saying, now read the book, or go, which is cross-promotion at its best.
You mentioned something that I didn't really know, because we hear a lot about the big prestige acting productions where people have 4, 5, 6 weeks to rehearse. A film like this, there's no rehearsal at all, is there?
No. Most films are like that now.
Really?
You jump in the deep end. Rehearsal is a luxury. It's a huge investment. I mean, just a few days, one day of sitting around and talking about it, I think pays off. But just the economics are against it. Stuff is rarely reshot, whereas in my day, my early days, it was. Unless something is drastically, you know, wrong that would prevent the film from being cut together. And that's why I mention, you know, the importance of having a place to go to. You know, there's a tremendous draining of energy. People who come to a film set expect it to be entertaining. It's not, of course.
It's sitting around most of the time.
It's like, it's down the salt mine. But I think the actor needs to get away to his little trailer and rehearse. Try every option. Try things, you know, in different ways and whatever. And then, because that's the only time you get.
So if you're not rehearsed, okay, and you just show up, and you're filming something out of sequence, that makes it extremely hard, I would think. You say you like it, but it makes it extremely hard. How do you develop a character?
Well, I think you have to do a lot of homework, you know, preparation. No, you don't just show up, of course. You put in a lot of work. You've had discussions with the director. You've got to be in sync about this, about where you want to go. Otherwise, because there's nothing worse than holding up production while you argue it out, and this happens a lot. No, I think you've got to have some clear idea, but to be flexible enough that these ideas will bend and change and reflect, you know, location. Often we didn't know quite where we were going to be. I mentioned that some locations were denied us because the little bribes that had been promised weren't paid, and we had to, you know, find new things.
Is that fairly typical these days, even for large budget productions, of kind of having to scout around and change things at the last minute?
It happens a lot. I mean,
really?
You know, someone gets sick, for example, and you have to sort of change the day's filming. You can plan, you can prepare, but there's always that X factor that kicks in.
There's also something that you call, that I'd never heard of, called guerrilla filmmaking. What is that?
Well, that's sort of smash and grab, illegal filmmaking, where you go out with a camera and, and try to be as unobvious as possible and get footage. I mentioned that we did it on the subway, on the famous metro in Moscow. It was impossible or so bureaucratic to get, it's not allowed, and to get permission, you know, so we just did it.
Is that common?
I'm not sure.
I mean, is it common, say, in when you're doing a film, you know, in New York or L.A.?
I suspect it's more common than I realize, than everyone realizes.
Well, you make a comment about doing a little guerrilla filmmaking.
I heard the Constant Gardener was done that way.
Really?
Yes, I was listening to an interview with Ralph Fiennes, and apparently the director loved to just go out with a small unit and a camera and just pick up stuff.
You also did some action sequences, and you got pretty banged up. That's pretty common?
Oh, yes. I thought I'd buckled my swash a long time ago, but no. You're supposed to have stunt doubles and so on, but really, realistically, cinema is such a close-up medium that, you know, you've got to get in there and involved. And also, I guess there's a certain pride that one can still do it. In other words, the stupidity is still functioning about, you know, physical things. No, I did have a double, and I was grateful for it because I mentioned that the organization wasn't ideal, let me put it diplomatically. And we'd often find ourselves dueling or fighting or doing dangerous stuff at 3 o'clock in the morning on a dark, damp, wet day, which is not ideal.
Well, you also got very sick during that period. When you're sick, you still keep working if you can.
Oh, of course you do. The show goes on. Yes, I mean this is a given. Right back from the days, I remember there was a tour of the National Theatre, where of some third world country, and the whole company was sick, and they were performing in dieters. So, but you do. I mean, it's amazing how people rise to the occasion.
Have you ever had to perform a love scene with someone who's sick?
Not that I can remember, thank goodness. but it's, you know, la grande illusion. But often not sick, but often someone you've met that morning. And it happens to be the first scene in the movie. You know, hello, hello, hello. This is a pleasure to be working with you. Now, you know, get on with it.
Michael York, you mentioned in the book that the first scene of Cabaret where you arrive in Berlin was also the same day they filmed the last scene.
Yes.
When you're leaving.
Yes, that's right. Moments later.
When you're doing that, how do you change your mindset so quickly?
Well, you try and act it. That's it. I mean, ideally, films would be shot sequentially. You begin at the beginning, it would make sense, but you don't do it that way. You're all over the script. So very often the very last scene is shot first, which actually is quite good because it demands that you put in some homework and have a clear idea of what kind of arc you want to play and that you understand all the parameters, that if you have you have different colors to play, you don't present them all at once. Although this can be dangerous, trying to second guess not just a director, but particularly an editor. You know, you have to live with the humiliating knowledge that basically you're providing raw material for someone else to cut into shape.
So there's a certain point where there's this fear. There must be this great fear then when you walk into the finished movie because you never, ever know what you're going to get.
That's exactly it. Yes, and sometimes you're delighted that the editor has trimmed away those horrible excesses and embarrassments. But I remember Hugh Wheeler, who revised the screenplay for Cabaret, saying at the press screening, oh, goodness, you know, it's either very good or very bad. there's no telling. But in a way, it's like the theater, you know, where you have this communion between the actors and the audience. I think a certain amount happens in the cinema, too.
One thing that Are My Blinkershoen does is it shows us what the life of an actor is in and around the set, and it isn't just being on the set. It's constantly, you mentioned, it's constant party going where all you want to do is go home and work on the script, but you're kind of committed to promoting your film at the same time.
Yes, I mentioned this, and in fact, I apologize for a certain sort of puritanical atmosphere on my part or attitude. You know, my point of view is that, you know, that if you give, and I put this to the test over, you know, 30 years or more, that if you give a film 100% of your application, your talent, whatever that is, and your industry, then you can walk away from its outcome saying, well, I really did my best. And but if there are these distractions and parties and so on, and it's very tempting, especially if you're away from home and you're in this foreign environment. But their point of view was that the parties were for journalists. They wanted to, you know, to keep the word going. And I was saying, no. Usually what happens is that you give a party at the end. It's called the cast party, where everyone, you know, they've earned the right to party. Whereas, you know, if these parties happen, you know, during the course of filming, they're energy inefficient and distracting. But you know, my point was heard but not heeded.
Well, before we went on the air, we talked a little about politics in America and what's happening
mm-hmm.
here. You grew up in Britain, but you've lived in America,
yeah.
you know, for the last 30-something
years. I'm an American now.
You're an American now.
Yeah.
How do you deal with these comments about Bush just when you're overseas? People out there don't really like us anymore.
No, they don't. They don't. And I think in Russia they particularly resented Bush finger wagging and saying this is the way, you know, you have to. I think they were, you know, when he claimed to have looked into Putin's soul or whatever, I think they just laughed. But I saw strangely parallels. What's happening in this country where the Patriot Act has taken away certain freedoms in the name of security. Putin's doing the same thing in Russia in the name of security. You know, and particularly what concerned me at the time, I mentioned this in the book, is the infringement on freedom of the press. There were very few, and when I went back for the premiere, there were even less. You know, I was on a television show, and it was one of the last ones to go out live. All the others, particularly the news programs, are all edited. So this is the democracy of the dictator. And in a way, he has a point. I remember when he was on 60 Minutes and he explained in this wonderful, seductive way how, you know, what's right for Russia is not necessarily right for America. But in this country, there are these strange parallels that you see the media in the hands of a few oligarchs who, you know, have their way in a very subtle, subliminal way.
What do you think of the role of the artist is in all this? Do you think that the role of Michael York, the actor, is there anything that you can do to educate people?
I think it becomes more and more important.
Does it?
I think in the old Shakespearean sense of holding the mirror up to nature to try and make people understand. And I think this is what the great literature has always done. This word spin is in constant use here, and you sense that everything is being, you know, spun, and in this, you know, this endless homage to Goebbels and what he was able to achieve, that you don't know what the truth is. So you need to go back to basics. And I think the artists can remind people of basic truths. I don't want this to sound pretentious, and every time you go near that. For example, the next thing I'm doing is I was asked out of the blue to headline a revival of the musical Camelot. And I suddenly thought, by God, this is a good time for it, to be reminded that leadership in politics could be idealistic. And why not?
You're listening to an interview with Michael York, whose book is titled Are My Blinkers Showing? I'd like to shift gears and talk a little bit about your career. Your earliest work was in the Forsyte Saga. Now, before that, you were in the National Youth Theatre in England?
Yes, National Youth Theatre as a youth, which is fantastic. It had just started. It's now, you know, a strong institution in Britain. But it had just started in London, and we would put on these shows in the West End of Shakespeare. It was initially boys, then the girls came in, then the whole country joined in. And it's a wonderful idea. It's the idea of not being to turn out little stars, although, you know, this did happen. People went on into the business. But basically, you know, the value of that, of putting on a show, what it does, the discipline, all these positive values, the self-esteem. And then, you know, people took these values to, you know, life outside of the youth theatre. I was at Oxford, too, which in my day and still is a great unofficial drama school. And my contemporaries were the Monty Pythons. I was in the same year as Michael Palin and Terry Jones. And indeed, we would go up to the Edinburgh Festival with these, they had the genius to take that clever dick, surrealist, undergraduate humor and run with it and universalize it.
So you were friends with these guys?
Oh, yeah.
You still in touch with them?
Yes.
Have you seen Spamalot?
I have. Yes, it's fabulous. It's wonderful. It's everything they've said it is and more. And I think we all need a good laugh at this time, and it provides it.
Your first job was with Forsyte Saga.
No, I went into rep in Dundee, which is a fabulous way of getting basic training in the theatre by doing it. And I did that for a bit. Then I went to the Laurence Olivier invited me to his new National Theatre Company.
How'd you meet Olivier?
Well, by auditioning, this dreadful process that never goes away. Again, I auditioned for the Royal Shakespeare Company, and they offered me parts. I auditioned for the National Theatre, and they said, you can join on Monday in a production of Much Ado About Nothing that Franco Zeffirelli is going to direct. And I was faced now with this thing that every actor has, choice. You know, do you do this or do you do that? Because there's no blueprint for a career. And my instinct, and these are all you have to go on, and you refine them, and you know, this is what guides you, I think, was to go to the National Theatre and actually work for a god, because I must say I worshipped Olivier. And, you know, it was a huge thrill that he was one's boss. But it was working with Zeffirelli in this production of Much Ado, which was famous. It starred Maggie Smith with Beatrice and Albert Finney and Derek Jacobi and Ian McKellen and Lynn Fregrave. I mean, they were all in it. And a year later, he asked me to go and audition for his production of Taming of the Shrew. So I flew down to Rome with a whole lot of hopefuls, and I was the very lucky one who got the role.
So you worked with Taylor and Burton on that?
I did, yes.
Did you get to know them at all?
Yes. I mean, I couldn't claim to be bosom buddies, no, but they were the producers of the film, and, you know, they were very nice to me. I shall always be grateful for them for giving me that chance. And, in fact, at the end of the movie, they sent me a framed photograph with this in a silver frame, and it was engraved, Dear Michael, you will tread bigger boards than this, and if not, we want to know the reason why.
You also work with Zeffirelli on Romeo and Juliet. Now, you talk about, obviously nobody's going to turn down Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet.
I did.
But you did?
I was doing something else.
Really?
Yes. And he said, well, don't be ridiculous. He said, I'm not offering you Romeo. I'm offering you a small part. You know, I need you for 2 weeks. So I made arrangements. And of course, I was there 3 months.
So what were you working on that was so important?
It was another movie. But it was also for Paramount. So they did some arrangement, and I was able to have my cake and eat it, which is my ambition in life.
You also did a film called Accident with Joseph Losey,
yes,
who went over to England because he was blacklisted. Did you ever get a chance to talk to him about that?
Yes.
And what did he talk about?
Well, not much. I mean, I've learned much more subsequently reading biographies of Joseph Losey. It also should be mentioned at this point that the script of Accident was written by Harold Pinter, who has just been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. And, in fact, Harold had a small role in the movie, and he's distinguished in this film by being the only one who can't get the Pinter pauses right.
when you were working on that, was he there the entire time talking to Losey about how to do it?
No.
Did he give you notes or anything? Or?
No. I think he was very interested. We had a cricket match. There's a scene of playing cricket, and it's very interesting. All our major playwrights are huge cricket fans. Simon Gray, Tom Stoppard, you name them. There's something about the game that has a literary connection, and one day someone's going to do the definitive book about this and bore you with it.
How was Zeffirelli as a director? I mean, compared to other directors who you later worked with?
I think what worked wonderfully, when he was working on these, on Shakespeare's Italian plays, and doing them in an Italian way. And I first saw this production of Romeo and Juliet at the Old Vic with John Stride and Judi Dench. And Alec McCowan was Mercutio, and it was amazing. It was so Italian. You really felt the mad blood stirring and the dog days and so on. So I think he works very well with Anglo-Saxons. I think, you know, he has this operatic, maybe not excess, but this side to him, which I think all Italians do, and Florentines. And he pulled out of our sort of Anglo-Saxon sang froid, a sort of extra element, and we sort of damped down that, you know, slightly over-the-top quality, and you had a perfect sort of match.
Michael York, you then went on to do a movie called Justine, directed by George Cukor.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the only time you worked with Cukor?
Yeah, although we ended up living in the same street as neighbors, so I would occasionally drive him to functions and so on.
Was he a raconteur? Did he tell great stories, or did he keep it to himself? I mean, this is a guy who is one of the top Hollywood directors.
He did invite me to his house for a drink, and I passed that house on a daily basis now, and it was full of stories. You know, at the end of the street, Hepburn and Tracy had their little sort of love nest. Now, again, I found out much more from subsequent biographers, and I wish I'd been au fait with everything I knew about him to be able to talk about it at the time. And also a certain respect, I think, for the great masters.
When I talked to Richard Chamberlain, he was saying that one of his great regrets was, you know, not sitting down with people like Katharine Hepburn and just pumping them, because it's the only time you're going to get a chance to do it.
And Scott Berg did that on our behalf, which
right.
is fabulous. I remember once being in a men's room, and, you know, I sort of connected with, I'm just aware of the person next to me, and it was Charlie Chaplin. And I said, good morning. It was late in the evening. I was so astonished. And, of course, one didn't think of saying, you know, may I take this opportunity to thank you for everything you've given to the world. Of course, you don't. And like Richard, you know, you live in subsequent regret.
But you also said that, before we went on the air, that you don't regret what you've done. You only regret what maybe you didn't do.
Yeah,
I mean, and you've done a huge amount of body of work.
That's intentional. I know that there are other actors with a different temperament who are much more careful and choosy before they dip their toe in the water. I'm a bit of an Aries. I just plunge straight in. And I'd much rather, I think you learn so much more from working. You learn so much more when things are not going right than when they are. As someone observed, nobody takes notes on a love affair. It's when things are going wrong that you know.
You get the story.
Yeah.
You also did a movie called Something for Everyone, which isn't particularly remembered now, but it was an incredible black comedy with Angela Lansbury, directed, I think it was the first film directed by Harold Prince.
It was.
Yeah.
Yes, and Hugh Wheeler did the screenplay.
So it was basically the old Sondheim crowd in film.
Yeah, exactly. it was one of my favorites. And it played underground. It was a sort of underground classic for a long time. And now, of course, it's above ground. And, I think it's a DVD. And praise the Lord for DVDs. It remains one of my favorites. It's sort of outrageous. What I loved was, stage becoming a great friend with Hal Prince and his gang, as you said, Sondheim.
Have you ever had any interest in working on something on Broadway with these folks?
Yes, I have. Hal asked me to be in his production of Little Night Music, in fact, but I was one of those things, that got away. I was doing something else. Yes, and I do go back to Broadway, but not on a regular basis, but... I think it was Charlton Heston who said you have to go back and get your passport stamped, otherwise they take it away.
When you're working on a lot of films and just doing these things out of sequence, dealing with sitting around and then you have, one sentence of dialogue that you repeat for a whole hour or two and then move on, it seems that you're getting awfully far away from why you got in the business to begin with, which is acting.
I don't agree with that.
Really?
No, it's horses for courses. It's a different media. When I was a young actor and first came out to Hollywood, for example, I was shocked that the British way of doing things didn't apply. There were film actors, there were TV actors, there were radio actors, and there was no crossover. They all kept stuck in their corners. Whereas the British tradition was that you did everything. You went off and made your film to make some money so that you could go off and do a play, and you went down to RTBBC and turned out a radio play, you went and recorded some books. So I always insisted on that. From the moment I hit Hollywood in the mid-70s, I always did that, because I thought that's the way it should be done. And now I'm happy to say there is much more crossover.
So you always did everything and never lost.
But that. I do agree with you. I think if you are sitting around in a highly technical medium, as we are talking now, we're whispering into microphones, you need to get back into a space where you can use your body and your voice in a much more physical way. That's what you're trained to do. But I do love the movies, and I think they do demand tremendous resources, physical resources and imaginative resources. But I wouldn't want to, be stuck in a pigeonhole marked movie actor or even stage actor. I would still love that freedom to do everything.
You've been listening to part one of a two-part interview with Michael York, whose latest book is Are My Blinkers Showing? Adventures in Filmmaking in the New Russia. The interview concludes next Thursday at the same time. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.